If we keep moving this way, we're guaranteed regret.
I didn't cross the border, the border crossed me. Can't call my folks illegal if you're same across the sea. I didn't cross the border, the border crossed me. Can't call my folks illegal if you're same across the sea. I didn't cross the border, the border crossed me. Can't call my folks illegal if you're same across the sea. I didn't cross the border crossed me. Can't call my folks illegal if you're same across the sea.
Times haven't changed, feels like Trump wanna make the indigenous go away. Illegal is the term being used freely. Know the bloodline of your family, cause Europe isn't close. I'll walk across the Mexican border. For your land, I'll need a plane and boat. The doctrine of discovery gives the right to steal.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
We're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2H2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's the end of an era. Tune in to KBOO on Friday, September 13th for the series finale of The Gap, Friday talk radio hosted by Tammy and Althea. It may be the end of their weekly sojourn into Portland politics and community conversation, but let's send it off with a bang. The finale of The Gap is at 8 a.m. this Friday, only on KBOO.
Say goodbye to these!
KBOO. If you stop to listen, you can hear their hearts beating loud. Can't keep those California Indians down.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves. For Marcus Lopez, I'm your host, Larry Smith. On today's program, with over 20 fires throughout the state of California, we'll speak with the leading California Indigenous scholar and cultural practitioner of traditional fire management practices on what climate resilience, eco-stewardship, and Indigenous stewardship looks like for the futures of California Indigenous peoples and life here on Mother Earth. You're listening to American Indian Airwaves.
You can hear when the moon shines bright, the lone blue air in the black of the night. You can hear the whisper in the valley. And you know when Kamakani blows to the bahu drum, mystery to me.
As of the morning of September 10th of 2024, the fires have burned more than 2 million acres throughout the politically defined borders of the United States. In fact, there are 71 large active fires with more than 20 fast-moving fires within the state of California. Within California, because of the fires and the heat wave, there are mandatory evacuations for tens of thousands of people, including in the counties of San Bernardino, Riverside, Orange County, and at the foothills of the Los Angeles National Forest and Lake County in Northern California. Today on American Indian Airwaves, our guest for the hour and this two-part interview is Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation. He is professor of geography and planning at California State University, Chico State, and is the co-founder for the Indigenous Stewardship Network. He joins us today on American Indian Airwaves to discuss the 2024 California fires, its impact on California indigenous peoples and nations, and climate resilience through ecocultural stewardship. We begin today's interview on his immediate thoughts on the large number of fires currently in the state of California.
No, I think that's a good starting point. I mean, certainly we have a lot of fires that are active across particularly Western North America and within the, you know, confines of the political boundaries of the United States, as you said. We've got a lot of fire activity in Oregon and Washington and, you know, kind of the Intermountain West states, but then also here in California. And, you know, there's a lot of different nuances to why some of those fires are occurring. I'll speak more to what the experience is here in California in the sense that we've had the prior season, the rainy season, the wet season, had a lot of precipitation that came to support a lot of growth of grasses, particularly in the lower elevation foothill regions. And, you know, coming into the season, it always comes down to what are our sources of ignition, right? So if we don't have lightning events that are going to happen, you know, it mostly always comes back down to where are the human ignitions and human-caused ignitions coming from. And that's the real gamble that we always face, I think. But given the amount of precipitation that occurred and the growth of grasses and now multiple years of buildup of those grass fuels, we really were in an alignment where this particular season, going into the dry season, I felt that the foothill region was going to be something to watch out for. And again, it comes down to what are our ignition sources and then what are the conditions in which those fires occur. So kind of if I think back to the various fires that have occurred across the state going back to, I don't know, May, June, into July, and even during the time of some of the fires that erupted and became quite large very quickly, like the Park Fire did, there were a lot of other fires that were happening simultaneously that were relatively small based on where they were at. So if those fires were burning in the forested environments higher up in elevation, a lot of those areas still had a lot of moisture in the soil, a lot of the fuels still had a lot of moisture, but those grasses, those non-native annual grasses down in the foothills were cured out. And, you know, the thing is that in the absence of, like, wind, a lot of those fires, even in the grasses, they grow relatively quickly because it's a fine fuel and it carries fire pretty easily. But when you add the wind factor to it, that's where you have this rapid growth of the fire. And so I'll give an example, like here in Butte County where I'm at. Earlier in the season, there was a Thompson fire just a few weeks before the Park Fire, and that grew to over, 1,000-plus acres. I don't remember the exact acreage of it. I want to say maybe closer to 1,600 acres, but, you know, it was in the same kind of foothill environment, mostly non-native annual grasses, oak woodlands, and a little bit of brush, but pretty small fire. While it grew quickly kind of later in the afternoon, like, it didn't spread too abruptly, whereas the Park Fire happened on a day at the kind of the hottest time of the day when we typically see the peak and the fire behavior starting to spike, that ignition time, you know, about, you know, after 2:30 in the afternoon on a day at the bottom of a canyon, grass fuels, slope and wind on it, really led to a very different kind of fire behavior, which I would say kind of stands out as an anomaly in terms of how quickly it grew in relationship to these other fires that have happened across the state.
Don, for our listeners, can you give them a sense of how the fires have impacted California Indigenous nations and what the implications are?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously fires are set. They've happened all across the state. You know, if I kind of think, and I'll obviously miss some, but as I think about where some of these fires have been in the state, you know, we've had fires up in the Klamath River region that have, you know, been within the Karuk ancestral territories. As we think about the Park Fire, it actually has burned across multiple tribal territories, but mostly within the traditional homelands of Yahi, Yana, Konkau-speaking peoples, and also Mountain Maidu communities in their ancestral homelands, and you know, and then currently over in Lake County in Pomo homelands on the western side of Clear Lake, there have been fires down in the Mariposa area and Southern Miwok Nation homelands. And, you know, working our way south, there's obviously fires in Southern California and in the coastal range, which have impacted other tribal communities such as Esalen and Chumash and Kauia, you know, going further south into those ancestral places. With one, you know, thinking about currently the Line Fire, and as you referenced earlier, in San Bernardino County, is one that is definitely, you know, in places that have you know, cultural importance as well.
Don, I ask a question because so often when it comes to settler colonial legacy or mass media performances and the coverage regarding these fires, right, what Americans know as the climate crisis, that Indigenous peoples, and in this case, California Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations, are often censored from these stories. And so, you know, we hear about the fires, we don't hear about California Indigenous peoples and how they're being impacted, let alone we don't hear about how the past connects to the present in talking about these fires and where we are right now. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say that's a fair characterization. I mean, obviously, you know, I highlighted the prevalence of these non-native grasses, and you know, if we think about the origins of those non-native grasses, like that goes right back to, you know, the arrival of and even predating in some cases the actual colonization event, so to speak, for like Spanish arrival in California. You know, because some of our invasive plants actually arrive by just seed transport by ships along the coast. But yeah, these, you know, these non-native annual grasses, which are annuals, they grow early in the dry season, you know, beginning of the dry season, they're kind of drying out. Whereas our native, you know, grasses and forbs, they behave totally differently. So we've had an entire landscape change, right? To give some context, and most of the listeners would appreciate that, you know, we've obviously as Indigenous peoples have had major population declines just because of colonization. But then when we think about our ecosystems here in California in particular, some of these ecosystems like grasslands have been decimated in a similar way. You know, if we think about native grasslands in California, they represent less than 2 or even 1% of what the historic extent of them was. So we've had a major shift, and that major shift really makes this landscape much more vulnerable to you know, these kinds of fire, but also in terms of like the climate resilient side of it, it's, you know, it's that much more challenging because we really need to do a lot more in terms of restoring native species back into the landscape and the, you know, the kind of buffering, if you will, that those species provide against, you know, these differences in like moisture deficits and the seasonality of that, but then also how that relates to fire.
Don, as I'm listening to you talk about the legacy of biocolonization, you know, I can't help but think about California Governor Newsom. Back in 2020, he assigned the California 30 by 30 initiative with the objective to conserve 30% of California's lands and coastal waters by 2030. But in California, the legacy of, say, the National Park Service and even land conservation in general has this settler colonial legacy or genealogy or roots in an ideological form of white supremacy. And so I'm thinking of, you know, Madison Grant's passing of the Great Race, who was also, you know, an advisor to President Roosevelt, along with John Muir and others, that led to Roosevelt, you know, signing the bill to become a law that created the National Park Service. And here in the state of California, the National Park Service has this legacy of dispossessing California indigenous peoples out of their lands. So your thoughts on that as we talk about ecocultural stewardship in climate resilience?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, conservation has been applied within the United States and many other areas of the world has really not been favorable to indigenous peoples. It tracks a lot of the same genocidal practices of removal forcibly and by death in some, you know, cases of peoples from their homelands. And sadly, you know, like this idea of fortress conservation, where we establish a park or a designated conservation area, and then it becomes hands off. This is actually a challenge that exists in that, you know, when we think about the values of what is actually being conserved in these places, the stewardship of those places is ultimately why some of those conservation values were of interest in the first place. So, you know, if we, I always like to use the example of Yosemite. Most people are familiar with it. Right. So if we think about, you know, what values John Muir and Theodore Roosevelt would have seen in the Yosemite region at the time when the national park was established, you know, the wide open floodplain of the Merced River and the scattering of deciduous oaks like black oaks and so forth, with a periphery of conifers, you know, cedars and sugar pines and things like that, which, you know, under the conservation lens and then the removal of indigenous stewardship practices and ultimately also the removal of fire, at least until the 1970s, we see a major change in how that landscape became totally different than what it was under indigenous stewardship. The forest got much more dense, the meadow grew smaller, and there's a whole cascade of ecological impacts that have occurred because of that.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation. He's professor of geography and planning at California State University, Chico State, and is co-founder of the Indigenous Stewardship Network. We're speaking on the 2024 California fires, its impact on California indigenous peoples and nations in climate resilience through ecocultural stewardship and more. And now back to the interview here on American Indian Airwaves.
So, you know, you can take any myriad other example of conserved areas across the state, across the nation, where, you know, we put up these boundaries and we changed the way that the stewardship had been in place for millennia. Right. In these locations, and ultimately the outcomes of what we're trying to achieve there are diminished. We're not able to achieve the same values, and I think that's where there's definitely an awakening that's occurring, both at the state and federal level. There's, you know, a reckoning, if you will, that the past policies of exclusion haven't worked to achieve, you know, both the conservation goals, climate resilience goals, and you know, those other ecological, outcomes, and the recognition that, oh, indigenous stewardship is the thing that that helped to maintain those, and we need to get back to it. And it's a little bit of an interesting time because there is that recognition, but then where and how do we start to unpackage the opportunities for people to re-engage in places, and who is being allowed to do that, and what are the mechanisms by which they're allowed to do that? There is a lot there that needs to be sorted through.
So when we talk about traditional ecological knowledge or indigenous stewardship, just kind of an extension to what you just shared with us, you know, what kind of, and we've been talking about biocolonization, invasive species, and, and the implications for, California indigenous peoples and elsewhere, because the state of California is a political border, and there are no boundaries across Mother Earth. But, what are some of the major obstacles that you see despite the current dialogue and interest regarding indigenous stewardship? So I'm thinking of, when non-native people come to the table, and there's this whole legacy of settler colonialism that's vastly changed a lot. Who gets to decide how quick and how to implement these processes of decolonization, if you will, and re-indigenizing the land for cultural sustainability for future generations?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point, and there's a lot of different angles that I could respond to that. I'll start by one just saying that one of the biggest challenges I would say is the knowledge base, and not so much that the knowledge is not necessarily there within indigenous communities, because the knowledge is definitely still there through the intergenerational storytelling that people have passed down from the times when that stewardship was still occurring, and in some cases it still exists within families, but at a totally different scale. So being able to upscale it, if you will, across communities, back into the landscape, and really getting it to the landscape scale, there's some nuances of having the ability to do that based on the practicalities of, okay, maybe 2-3 generations since being able to apply that knowledge, how does it actually work on the ground? And so in some cases, it's a matter of refamiliarizing oneself and knowledge base around those practices, and I don't see that as insurmountable. Like, I see, like, the land will always teach, and right. Like, that ancestral knowledge is really something that is adaptable to situations. And so if you're versed in that understanding, then you're able to really see where that knowledge base could be applied, and then respond to how things went when you did apply it. Mm-hmm. The bigger challenge is really, I would say, like, access. When we think about the like the fortress conservation conversation we just had, people right. have been removed from having connection to the land. And so not only do we have conserved areas, but we've also got private land ownership that occupies vast areas of the state and nation, as the United States is concerned. And while there may be knowledge of specific things within tribal communities, of things that are within their ancestral landscapes, it may, again, have been a few generations since people have physically had access to see some of these things and to interact with them. And so access is a big piece, and if you don't have land to have access to, then it's really hard to have a place to steward. In conversations that I've had with a lot of traditional cultural practitioners, a lot of those access opportunities have really come about from they themselves asking and making the relationships individually to have the so-called permission to be on certain places to gather basket plants and food plants and things like that, be it on private land or public lands. And so, you know, that access piece is a big one. And I think that, you know, as we start to see more interest in Indigenous stewardship, more both public lands and private lands will start to open up to that access. But then, again, it also comes down to then thinking about the third layer of that, which is the policies that we have in place that allow for that stewardship to occur. So how do we then think about the alignments of, say, Forest Service policies versus the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's policies as agencies, and then their, you know, the departments above them, how do they allow for the Indigenous stewardship to occur? In the case of fire, in both of those situations, of like those departments at the federal level, you know, they're ultimately going to defer back to the National Wildland Coordinating Group standards for wildland fire, and that is not something that is inherent to the way that as Indigenous peoples, like fire stewardship, training, learning, knowing, doing, is applied, and so. You know, it's a different knowledge base. It's a different set of qualifications to be able to do things. And that's where some of the rub lay currently. And then we also have a misalignment of some of the, environmental policies. And, you know, over my career, I've seen, you know, situations, and I would say at this point, and I probably wouldn't have said this like years back, but certainly seeing that one of our barriers is actually, you know, environmental compliance. You know, how do we get through the National Environmental Policy Act or the California Environmental Quality Act, you know, kind of locally, to really scale things? Mm. And while we can write these more programmatic types of plans, both of these policies were written in a time frame where the role of fire and particularly the role of Indigenous fire stewardship weren't even recognized. You know, these policies were written in the late 60s, early 70s, and they just flat out didn't recognize the role of fire as a natural process and the role of Indigenous peoples in stewarding these things. So then we can also think about other policies that came out in that same time frame, the Endangered Species Act, both at the federal and state level, and then also the Clean Air Act, and those are examples of some of them. And we also add the Wilderness Act to that. You know, like, these are federal policies that, and state level policies that have hindered to some extent the ability to actually be stewards on the land. And so, you know, like, I think those elements that I've described really hit to some of the main things, and then probably the fourth level thing would be, you know, really thinking about how do we build the workforce around it, if you want to think about it that way. And you know, some might be thinking workforce in terms of the job opportunities and the economic opportunities, but then I also think about it in terms of like the traditional responsibilities of stewardship. Right. You know, and while not everybody within a traditional tribal community would have had, you know, fire in their toolbox for things that they had responsibilities to, ultimately a lot of those traditional lifeways and livelihoods are based on the use of fire. So you know, building that kind of so-called workforce side of it is another thing. And there's a lot of tribes and, you know, tribal organizations that are kind of working on those things currently. But the question, I guess, is like, which pathway are you taking to get there? Are you taking the pathway of the National Wildland Coordinating Group for fire, let's say, which may lead to a totally different culture of fire than if you're just using traditional approaches to teaching and learning and implementing fire? And so there's kind of a dichotomy that's I'm seeing emerging in terms of how people are utilizing it now.
When I'm listening to you talk about the settler colonial legacy of regulation at the state and federal level, and you know, some of these environmental regulations, they were implemented, you know, even in the early 70s, and, you know, people that are familiar with history, that's often associated with the era of the Red Power movement. But what I'm hearing from you is just whether it be at the state or federal level, is this just long settler colonial legacy where Indigenous sovereignty, California Indigenous sovereignty, has been completely ignored, erased, and there's been no practice by the state of free prior informed consent. And that's still true today, or relatively true.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of nuance to that.
Right.
When we look at the state of California as a Indigenous population is concerned, there's a lot of mixing to that. So what I'm saying is that we've got folks who are from California tribes, and those tribes are either they have federal recognition status or they don't. To my knowledge, there's roughly, half of California Indians are not fully recognized.
Right.
And that in part has to do with things like the establishment of rancherias for homeless Indians in like the Central California region as kind of one example. Just the time frame of when these things happen. There's a lot of people on the practitioner side who are not from federally recognized tribes who are doing the work and are actually kind of nationally and internationally known for that work that they do. So there's that level of it. So there's a recognition side of it. But then we also have a lot of Native peoples from other outside of the state of California who now live in the state from a mix of different policies, including relocation policies and things like that. These ideas of like who is supposed to be consulted for doing these things, and who do you receive permission from in a free prior informed consent approach, gets to be a little bit challenging because people have been moved around a lot. When I think about some of these policies that are specific to federally recognized tribes, some of those tribes may not be necessarily on their traditional homeland, so to speak, but that's where they're at now. There's some politics that potentially is there within our tribal communities because of that. And I recognize like that's a really sensitive topic because obviously like tribal sovereignty is a very important thing, and I'm very much an advocate for that and support it. But I also see it that self-determination is, like if you really break down that term, like self is self, and as individuals we have our own sovereignty, and so for non-recognized peoples, as beneficiaries, as we would be defined in the Indian Self-Determination Act,
right.
That doesn't necessarily mean that it's a federally recognized tribe. It's a broader population of beneficiaries, right, which are all Indian people, and so I see that like these are things that are potentially some of the challenges in terms of how the state and federal government actually, start to work with peoples again and hope, with the hope of healing past injustices. But then, are you creating potentially new injustices because you're still maybe excluding people who should be at the table?
You're listening to American Indian Airwaves with Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation, Professor of Geography and Planning at California State University, Chico State, and he's also the co-founder of the Indigenous Stewardship Network. That concludes part one of this two-part interview here on American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking on how the California fires of 2024 are impacting California Indigenous peoples and nations and climate resilience through eco-cultural stewardship and more. We're going to take a short break here on American Indian Airwaves, and we'll be right back.
Speak your own language, never goodbye. Walk the red road, keep your head high. Sing a good song, sing a bird song. Sing a good song, sing a bird song.
precious than gold. Govern yourselves, don't let go. Sovereignty's more precious than gold. Govern yourselves, don't let go.
The song Sovereignty by Tracy Lee Nelson here on American Indian Airwaves. In the second half of today's program, we go back to our interview with Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation. He's professor of geography and planning at California State University, Chico State, and he is the co-founder of the Indigenous Stewardship Network. We're speaking on the 2024 California fires, its impact on California indigenous peoples and nations, and climate resilience through ecocultural stewardship and more. And now part two of our interview today on American Indian Airwaves. Complicating the matter, and this touches on what you mentioned earlier, you know, about private land and you know, for California indigenous peoples that don't have a land base per se. So I'll say here, you know, and what we know is Los Angeles County, you know, people, if they want to gather medicine for cultural purposes, you know, they have to get permission to go on private land, and sometimes they can't get that, you know, permission to go on someone else's land. And so that obviously it makes it harder for cultures in general just to breathe if you don't have those places where those traditional cultural relations thrive. And the means for cultural transmission is, you know, always cut off or complicated, or the integrity is undermined. And so when I think of, you know, what you were talking about earlier in private land, and we're talking about, you know, ecological resilience and indigenous stewardship and traditional ecological knowledge, and, you know, just within the state of California, large private land owners, if you will, are in the agricultural industry, and certainly California is has a major agricultural industry. So how does, commerce, if you will, in the state of California, you know, contribute to and does it compromise, you know, this ability for California indigenous traditional fire management practices and other traditional practices to live and thrive for cultural sustainability?
Yeah, that's a really great point. So, you know, in thinking about this situation of like the commerce side of it, one example that just happened to float in my head is like the situation of, you know, the conflict that exists currently between being able to do burns,
right,
and like the wine growers, you know, in places like the Napa Valley, and I mean, really, they're all over the state. Where I burn on the McCollumy River, uh-huh, we've got, you know, some of the top, you know, vineyards known in the state are in that area. Mm-hmm. I've not personally had a conflict there, but I know other practitioners, both indigenous and non-indigenous, who have had these kinds of conflicts because of their intent to burn, and you know, oh, there's this potential for smoke taint on the grapes, and you know, like, that's a real problem if we're going to say that we can't apply a process that's necessary for the health of the ecosystem and also the ability to sustain culture over the economics of you know, wine. That's a pretty sad state of affairs, I would say. Yeah. And so I think that's a challenge that we've got to work through. It's you know, that's just one example, but I can think of, you know, the potential conflicts in other kinds of agricultural industries as well. At the same time, I also recognize that, you know, some of our tribes are also some of the, you know, agricultural producers. Mm-hmm. And so where and how potentially could they be serving a role to step in and say, hey, we're not only producing commercially, but we're also integrating our culture back into our landscape by doing these you know, stewardship practices. And you know, maybe that's the you know, a bit of storytelling, if you will, that could occur in those spaces. Outside of the fire side of it, there's obviously like the water quality impacts,
right,
and you know, the fisheries impacts and those kinds of things that are ultimately interrelated to the broader discussion of this. But you know, I think some really important opportunities that are there around where these kinds of things could come into better alignment. And then at the same time, I also see where some traditional food crops are potentially of interest to some of these growers. And I think for our communities, like, we need to really think about, is that commercial production okay? And, you know, how potentially does that maybe lead to an infringement of traditional, you know, knowledge about things, but also just the use of those plants and those specific contexts.
The other part I was thinking of, you know, in talking about these various, you know, industry, agricultural industries and other industries and in relationship to, you know, these non-traditional fires that are so prevalent, for example, right now, is that, you know, there's in these respective industries, there with the fires, right, there's this air pollution. But, you know, part of that is the long legacy in the industry practices of using herbicides and pesticides and whatnot. So that creates this larger cesspool. And for native species or native plants and animals relations, if you will, you know, that toxicity of herbicides and pesticides and other chemicals, you know, get released out into the environment, and they invade, you know, those traditional plants and animals, which inversely affects California indigenous peoples, you know, people that go out and gather, you know, medicine and are cultural bearers of, you know, sacred knowledge. And so that gets passed on to California indigenous peoples.
Right. No, I definitely understand that. And you know, when you're just saying that, it kind of took me back to times in my earlier career when I worked with you know, species like California red-legged frog and, yeah, you know, species and amphibians up in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada. And, you know, one of the issues at that time, and still is an issue, but, you know, thinking about like pesticide drift and,
right,
you know, so if you have, you know, agriculture in the San Joaquin, Sacramento valleys using herbicides and pesticides, you know, as an aerosol, like that, the winds can transport those things quite far, you know, like even in the high lakes of the Sierras, research has found that those lakes have trace amounts of some of these pollutants in them. So, you know, the impacts are far reaching. And, you know, obviously, I don't think we fully understand the ecological consequences of some of those things, let alone the cultural side of it, you know. And so I think those are definitely valid points. Kind of coming back and circling back now and thinking about the forested environment, you know,
right,
like sometimes we forget that the forest is also considered a crop. And I have to sometimes remind myself that living in the forest, like I'm also a farmer in that sense, if we want to play the political game and, you know, like, oh, well, who grows trees, right? And who has a say on this? Well, yeah, I live in the forest and I own, you know, land with a bunch of these trees on them that, you know, some people might look at as a crop, you know, to harvest in terms of like the trees themselves. I look at it as a crop that, oh, like I get to collect pine nuts and things like that off of,
right.
You know, but you know, that side of it is that, you know, the mismanagement of some of these lands has actually, you know, led to an exacerbation of some of these effects like fires, right? So,
right,
you know, if we look at the landscape where these clear cuts, you know, exist in the area that I live in, you know, those lands are hot, they're dry, and they carry a very different kind of fire than what, you know, we would expect in a forest that's been maintained differently. Right. And so, you know, that is a, like another punch in the sense of what, how does that contribute to climate resilience, right? Right. So if we're, if we're able to circle back on that and say, okay, if we're able to apply fire and we're able to achieve a different structure of the forest from both the soil level and the, you know, soil organic components, and that's going to help to retain moisture in the soil, that'll prolong the moisture, live fuel moisture is in the plants, which will extend then the resistance of fire to be able to spread into these places. Like, you can kind of start to see the greater interconnectedness of those things. But if we're just going to clear cut and we lose soil organic matter and we lose the moisture in the soil, then that's going to accelerate the aridification of that landscape, so drying of that landscape.
John, when we're talking about space, you know, I can't help but think about, you know, in California, you know, how many California Indigenous peoples and their respective First Nations do not have a land base? How many live in urban spaces away from their traditional homelands? How many Indigenous peoples from elsewhere live in urban spaces in California Indigenous peoples' traditional homelands? So how does our discussion and all these different variables, if you will, or these situations contribute, do they contribute to the problem, you know, and how do, you know, California Indigenous peoples really cultivate those allies, even with the Indigenous peoples from elsewhere, in addressing, you know, this issue that we're talking about of climate resilience and equal cultural stewardship?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, you raise a really important question and an important point, and that is that regardless of where people live, I think it's important to build our connections with nature. You know, if you live in you know, an urban area like Los Angeles, you know, one, there's nature around you everywhere, even in the city, but you may not notice it. So I think one, starting to pay more attention to that, and then think about the things that are part of your purview in terms of being able to do something for that thing, right? So if it's, I don't know, think about like painted lady butterflies as an example. Like, right, what could you do as a person living in an apartment, let's say, for those butterflies? You know, could you put some plants out in, you know, in a planter outside that might provide nectar for them? You know, that's one level of building that connection. It's a very small thing that you can do to help, like, their populations. Obviously, that's a very specific example. Right. But, you know, the other side of it too is you know, how can you then leverage support for people who are doing the work out in the broader landscape? You know, out in the woods, out in the streams, and in different places. And you know, sometimes that means that, you know, maybe it's volunteering some time and connecting with people in these different places to see if, you know, a hand can be lent.
And we want to remind listeners, you're listening to American Indian Airwaves. We're speaking with Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation. He's professor of geography and planning at California State University, Chico State, and is co-founder of the Indigenous Stewardship Network. We're speaking on the 2024 California fires, its impact on California Indigenous peoples and nations in climate resilience through eco-cultural stewardship, and more. And now back to the interview here on American Indian Airwaves.
Sometimes it's offering some, you know, some, maybe some financial support, or, you know, those sorts of things are really important ways of making and maintaining community and connection. You know, but I think ultimately, you know, in order to really retain who we are as Indigenous peoples, it's important to maintain a connection to where we are from. You know, where is home? Where are our ancestors from? And, you know, that may be, you know, kind of short-term kinds of trips going home, you know, when there's vacation time and things like that. But connecting to land and connecting to the culture, I mean, they're inseparable. The land and the culture are and language are all one, but it's place specific, you know. So I think that's you know, an important step that people can engage in, and you know, like we, as I said, we all take responsibility. We all have a responsibility, and you know, like another thing that just kind of came into my mind is thinking about, well, you know, what if you're not living off the land, so to speak, and you know, stewarding the land, how can your personal choices in terms of products that you buy, foods and things like that, also then support the way that that is also supportive of the environmental choices that you want to make are also important, right? So, right. You know, recognizing that, you know, I'll use an example because it's come up in conversations I've had with people, you know, people's like some of the Washoe folks, you know, in the Tahoe area, you know, is that, well, you know, like you can go into some supermarkets around Reno sometimes and find pinions for sale, mm-hmm. but, you know, how and where are those pinions being collected, and is that impacting a family's traditional gathering spot? You know, so is the pinion being collected by Washoe tribal members or peoples from the surrounding tribal communities, or is it, you know, somebody else's commercial venture going out on public lands perhaps and, you know, harvesting maybe unknowingly in some cases, you know, from traditional gathering spots that families have responsibilities to. You know, those are some of the levels of questions that we maybe need to ask ourselves, is where is our food coming from and how is it being stewarded, right? And how does it conflict with infringement on other people's homelands, right?
Right. Well, I was wondering too is, you know, for so many people, California indigenous peoples, those that live in away from their traditional homelands and native people and just, you know, and cultivating allyship, you know, this notion of, you know, creating ecological corridors is a possible, you know, step towards healing the land and life and providing or contributing to, you know, cultural sustainability for California indigenous peoples whose traditional homelands we occupy. Your thoughts on that? And then what are some of the examples of California indigenous organizations and nations that have really taken those steps in climate resilience through eco-cultural stewardship?
Yeah, well, to get to your first point, if I understand what you're getting at is, you know, these corridors are important for a variety of different things, and I think for folks in Southern California and in your listening audience there, thinking about like the wildlife passage overpasses and things like that that are you know being developed. Are really critical as linkage points between areas that are otherwise quite isolated, and so we're trying to minimize, you know, the impact of say roads in animal migrations, but also that sometimes those roads also are barriers to say plant movement as well, and so by having these kinds of corridors, it opens up the ability for those things to occur. And, you know, in my classes that I teach where we talk about, like, these kinds of conservation approaches, you know, one of the things that, and it's not my idea to like, frame things this way, but, you know, we can sometimes frame things in this idea of the limitations of species, right? So, you know, limitations might be a species that is only found on a certain food plant. You know, use monarch butterflies as an example. We know that they like to use milkweed as their larval host plant. So, you know, if we have a species like that, and then we have a species that has a large home range need, like, you know, grizzlies as an example, and then, you know, we have something that has a very specific habitat requirement for sheltering or breeding in or something like that, like, we can start to combine these limitations in a way to think, okay, how do we start to plan the landscape differently, and recognizing that, like, that's going to change over time. Right. But ultimately, like, we've got these built areas of the environment that that are there, And as we think of the changes that occur because of climate change that is occurring, how do we allow for those species that were in our relations, as you said earlier, to move more fluidly across that landscape? And those places where they're able to move to are also places that are also then stewardship corridors, because you can't have many of these species present in these places if you're not actively stewarding for the habitat conditions that support them. Mm. So, you know, that could be done in a variety of ways in an urban environment. You know, as we use the example of the painted lady butterflies and planting some nectar plants for them, you know, in a flower bed is one example. But then, you know, there's like the green roofs and the green streets movements that are there that I think could also benefit from an infusion of indigenous ways of thinking of how do we steward water and how do we create habitat in places like this to break up the concrete and make things more green and to truly re-indigenize it in all sense of the word. Like, right, we're talking about our native plants, we're thinking about our stewardship, and we're doing it in our own neighborhoods. You know, I think is a big opportunity that's there, and you know, maybe that inspires some younger folks to think about, you know, potential careers in landscape design and architecture and things like that, that really help to truly heal the environment in a variety of different ways, even, you know, within our individual communities.
And Don, what are some of the California Indigenous nations or organizations or groups that are really taking the lead on climate resilience through ecocultural stewardship?
Yeah, really good question there. There's a lot of really great work that is taking place. I mean, some of it's happening within individual tribes. I think that in one of the more forward-thinking things is that I see a huge opportunity around, and this really helps to address some of the potential inequalities of federal recognition versus non-recognized and things like that we talked about earlier, is, you know, like intertribal organizations and, you know, collections of peoples from different, you know, from within a region, being able to work together outside of the bounds of their own state tribal governments, but working together for a common good. There's some really, really great examples of that sort of thing, I think, that are taking place. One that kind of comes to mind off the top of my head in thinking about, you know, the reference to the fire in Lake County area is the work of the Tribal Ecocultural Restoration Alliance, TERRA. Mm. You know, they're an intertribal group that has you know, involvement from many of the tribes in the Lake County area, working to revitalize fire practices in those places. And you know, so I think that's a good organization that's worth noting. You know, thinking about the Cultural Fire Management Council up in Northwestern California, also fire related. You know, I'm also a co-founder of one of the organizations that's you know, kind of in the phase of development and emerging, but the Indigenous Stewardship Network, as we call ourselves, is intended to really support Indigenous land stewardship and water stewardship and, you know, all of that in our space of the state primarily, although there's a lot of interest even outside of the state now for the organization. But, you know, a lot of our work is also mostly supported around fire, you know, and the traditional application of fire and the knowledge base there. There's also the California Marine Stewards Network, which is tribal as well. You know, and so, like, there's lots of different examples of that. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, in the fire space, I keep using those fire examples, but there's fire being carried out from, you know, like the San Diego County areas with Kumeyaay Nation folks all the way up to the Oregon, you know, Oregon boundary along the Klamath. And so, like, there's just a lot of really good work that's taking place. But again, you know, it's about getting it to scale to really make the changes necessary to be successful.
The moment of silence is over. Thank you.
And that was Don Hankins from the Miwok Nation. He's professor of geography and planning at California State University, Chico State, and co-founder of the Indigenous Stewardship Network. For more information on the Indigenous Stewardship Network, you can visit their website at indigenousstewardship.org. That concludes our show for today here on American Indian Airwaves. A special thank you to our guest, Don Hankins. A special thank you to our musical guests, Aragon Star, Koopa Aina, Tracy Lee Nelson, and the band Blackfire. American Indian Airwaves is mixed and mastered in the studios of Burnt Swamp Studios in Signal Hill, California. For Marcus Lopez, I've been your host for the hour, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Why your freedom manifests on their graves, and the blood never comes clean from the guilty minds, nor the hands that hold the chains.
Is KBOO Portland.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called